Hello, my name is Nicole, and my favorite thing is writing.
Welcome to the Finding Favorites podcast, where we explore your favorite things without using an algorithm. Here's your host, Leah Jones.
Hello, and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones, and this is the podcast where my microphone is broken. Hopefully it's just a cord. On this week's return from hiatus, from an unexpected hiatus, I found out that the cord to my Yeti microphone, it got broken in the few weeks when I wasn't recording. So I bought a new one, and I think the new one I bought was not a good replacement, because if you downloaded the first version of this podcast, you heard wild audio, and that was me being a lazy editor because I didn't listen to it back. I just dropped it in. So I'm re-recording this, and I am hopeful that this gets to most people. So Finding Favorites, the podcast where we learn about people's favorite things and get recommendations without using an algorithm. I disappeared for a few weeks because I was honestly busy doing some of my favorite things. That includes flying to LA to go to Largo to see live How Did This Get Made tapings and Dinosaur Improv. So I went in March and saw Dinosaur Improv, which included two people from Grand Crew, the creator Phil Augusta Jackson and Carl Tart. Carl, I got to see this summer at a couple Doughboys live shows. And then the next night was How Did This Get Made live, and the guest was Nicole Byer. So I was like out of my mind excited to see Nicole. And then I came home. I hosted a Passover Seder, not on the correct night, because I'm physically kind of not there yet, but I did a Saturday night Seder, which was really wonderful and exhausting. And then on my way to a conference in Austin, I took a detour back to LA and saw the third night of the How Did This Get Made residency, and just enjoying life as a super fan of live podcasts. I've also been having like a dip in my recovery, and that has been a bummer. I'm using my cane again and waiting for my new sarcoidosis medicine to start working. The methotrexate sort of was amazing for a few months and then it wasn't. So now I'm waiting for a biologic to kick in and start working. And, you know, I want so desperately to have my old life back, but I think we all know there's just new life. There's not a return to your old life. And that is, even though I studied it in grad school, very hard to accept in reality. But it was good to take some time off the podcast. I've been thinking a lot about, on the podcast Normal Gossip, they talk a lot about the work that goes into creating a season, and how to protect creators from getting burnt out. And that when you have a podcast that is a weekly interview podcast, with no scheduled breaks, how it can lead to burnout. And so this, you know, Memorial Day weekend will mark the start of year four for Finding Favorites. And I need to make sure that I'm finding ways to keep it sustainable. So I will continue to work on that. Something I'm really excited about is that I put out a call on Twitter and Facebook for people to interview and have so many exciting guests lined up for you. And we're kicking it off this week with author Nicole Zelnicker. They are a prolific author, even though she disagreed with me when I said that. They have four books out now, two already coming in the next 2 years. which is tremendous. We have a wide-ranging conversation about Broadway, the act of writing, and living with cats. And so I hope you enjoy this wonderful conversation with Nicole, and that you pick up some of their books and take a look at Knee Brace Press. And I'm also looking forward to next week being able to get my fourth booster, so COVID shot number 6, which have finally been approved for people who are immunocompromised. And so talk to your doctors and find a way to get that booster. And with that, wear your mask, wash your hands, and keep enjoying your favorite things. Hello and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones, and this is the podcast where we learn about people's favorite things and get recommendations without using an algorithm. It is also where we fight with microphone cords and weird audio, but we're back, and I am so happy to be here this evening talking with author Nicole Zelnicker. Nicole, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm good. Now that full body sweats of the tech setup not working.
You did awesome. It was a lot of stuff. So
thank you.
I think you did great.
I think Mercury's in the microwave right now, and it is
sure.
It is hitting us.
Yes.
Just for table setting, where are you in the world tonight?
That's an excellent question. I am in Carrboro, North Carolina. So I moved down here from New York maybe 2 years ago and lived in Chapel Hill, and currently in Carrboro, which is very, very close to Chapel Hill. It's very, very much over the line, so I haven't moved very far.
Is that the research triangle, Chapel Hill?
Yeah, it's right by Raleigh, which is kind of where all the research and the STEM people are.
Yeah. Very nice. I have a coworker who made a similar move early in the COVID lockdown.
Sure.
She and her partner were sharing a one-bedroom apartment. They had one good corner for Zoom. And the realization that, like, the lockdown was going to be more than 2 weeks.
For sure.
And they couldn't wrestle over the one good Zoom corner for much longer.
Absolutely. For me, it was when Broadway shut down. I was like, what am I still doing here? There's nothing else. There's nothing else for me.
Yeah.
In New York. Yeah.
Yeah. When there's no Broadway, there's no restaurants.
Yeah.
What was there to do?
Yeah. Like I live here for my friends, the food and the shows, and I'm getting none of those things. So I'm going to move.
Yeah. What were some of your favorite, Broadway shows isn't on your list, but.
Yes. Oh, I can talk about Broadway shows.
What were some of your favorites? Were there any that you returned to, or were you like a one and done Broadway person?
I've never actually seen the same show on Broadway twice, but I have seen the same show more than once. So like I saw Wicked on Broadway like years and years ago, and then I saw it more recently when it came here to the theater we have in Greensboro, which is about an hour from me.
Yeah.
And I've seen. I'm going to see Six a second time when it comes through touring. So I saw that like right before the shutdown. It hadn't opened yet because it didn't get to open until after Broadway reopened.
Oh, yeah.
So I saw that. I'm going to see Moulin Rouge when it comes through here, which I saw again like right before the shutdown. And I saw Rent for the first time recently actually here because that hasn't been on Broadway in a long time, but it came through touring. So that was exciting for me.
They did like a 5-year long 25th anniversary tour.
Yes, that is, that is what I saw.
It lasted a long time. Yeah, it was great. I saw it when it was on the, when it was like pre-pandemic, that part of the tour.
Yes. So I saw Hamilton here. I never actually got to see that on Broadway. I saw a lot of things on Broadway, but Hamilton is inordinately expensive to see on Broadway.
So. Yeah, it is. Yeah. I was lucky because Hamilton had a sit down in residency in Chicago.
Yes.
And so when they opened in Chicago, they were here for like 2+ years. And I was a very, I saw Hamilton a lot.
Absolutely.
Because you, like, in order to get Hamilton tickets the first time around, you had to get season tickets to this, to Broadway in Chicago. So I got season tickets. And then I realized Hamilton made me remember, oh, I love musical theater.
Yeah,
And so I've
absolutely.
been a subscriber to Broadway in Chicago, a lot of the same touring companies that you're getting ever
Yeah.
since.
Yeah,
So.
absolutely. Yeah, I do. I mean, I miss Broadway and I miss the variety that I got of shows, you know, because there are so many different things playing and it there are only really there's only really space for one thing to come through here at a time, but they do come through and they do you know, they're so good. That it's not a reason to move back to New
Right. And you can always take a weekend. I have friends that'll
Yeah.
go to New York for the weekend. I'm based in
To see
Chicago.
as many shows, yeah.
And I feel like I kind of want to do one of those. I really want to see Sweeney Todd with Josh Groban.
I would love to see that, yes.
Did you see Natasha and Pierre in The Great Comet?
I didn't know.
So that made turn me into a Josh Groban. I like didn't have an
Okay.
opinion of him, but then I saw him as
Sure.
Pierre and I was like, okay,
Yes.
he's actually a wonderful actor.
I did get to see Amber Gray in Hadestown, which was amazing.
Oh, yeah.
So I feel like that's the she's definitely probably my favorite actor from from The Great Comet.
Yeah.
So that was really cool. And then what are some of the other things that I saw before the shutdown? I don't I saw so many things.
Yeah.
I saw Aladdin like pretty soon before the shutdown, which that's been on for a long time, but I just it was one of the things that I just hadn't seen and
Yeah.
then
I
I'm glad I got to go.
shocked myself by going to see Aladdin twice when it came to town.
Sure.
I saw it in my subscription. And then I called my sister and I was like,
It's a lot of
I gotta
fun.
take my nephews.
Yes.
'Cause that magic carpet ride, I don't wanna know how they do it. I
No.
just, it's so wonderful.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. The whole friend like me dance sequence
Oh,
is amazing and
wonderful.
yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So yes, we
Yeah.
could just talk about Broadway for the next however long. That's I'll talk about musical theater forever. I'm wearing my Six shirt right now, so
Oh, nice. I wish I had been better prepared for six.
yeah.
Because it's, I felt like if somebody had said, get ready for like a Spice Girls power pop concert.
Yes. Feminist Hamilton type.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I thought there was going to be, I knew it was the six dead wives of Henry the Eighth,
The yeah.
but I thought there was going to be a little bit more of a storyline running through it.
I went into it, I think, pretty prepared. I knew pretty well what was going to happen.
Yeah.
And I'm laughing. Because when I went to see it, I went with two friends when I was living in New York that I saw a ton of shows with, and we sat down next to a woman who was maybe in her 60s, and she turned to us and saw, you know, a couple 20 somethings and was like, "Well, do you even know anything about Tudor England?" I was like, "Yes, ma'am. I have OCD, and that was one of my hyperfixations,
Yeah.
actually." So,
What do you want to know? Yeah.
So, but she's like, "Well, you guys were too young for the Tudors," and I was like, "No, we weren't. Like that was very much on when we were around, and that's not where I got the bulk of my information on
Right.
Tudor England, but that's fine." And it's also very much not a show that you need to know
No,
anything
you
about
don't
Tudor
need to know
England going into
anything.
it.
Yeah.
No, it's a lot of fun, but it's also I learned a lot even in that show and in the playbill. They have a lot of really cool facts about the queens and their lives. But what was funny was that she went into it having such an idea of what the show would be, and I would look over at her a couple times during the show while like the pop performances were going on, and she just looked scandalized. Like
Right.
she definitely had no idea what she was getting into. And then you know, as we were all getting up for the standing ovation, she just fled. She
Yeah.
just ran out of the theater. was
Yeah.
like, okay, well, maybe you know things about Tudor England, but I knew about this show, so
Right. Yeah, you knew
yes.
what you were coming for.
Yes.
I drove a couple friends up the wall because I was like, at a certain level, it is the same structure as Cats and Chorus in a chorus line,
Yes.
right? Each person has an introductory song.
Yes.
It's just that a chorus line and Cats have more people doing introductions. And that drives people crazy when I compare Cats in a chorus line, but
Right.
I hold the analogy.
It's a fair analogy, I think.
So I think it's one that if I saw it again, I would have a lot more fun because I wouldn't be like, wait, I don't, where this, what's the
Yes,
plot?
what's
Like,
happening? Yes,
yeah,
there is no plot. We're just here
there's
for
no
the
plot.
vibes. Yes, absolutely.
But I loved watching the crowd that night,
Yeah.
and the cast seems to have so much fun. All the different casts and ensembles on TikTok seem, they seem to have a
Yes.
blast. So I'm here for
Absolutely.
it. So Nicole, you are an author. You're a prolific
Yes.
author.
Oh God, I don't know about prolific. But yes, I do write books.
I guess I talk to a lot of first-time authors. So you already have four books out
Yes.
in the world, and your fifth is coming, is being published.
April 2024,
Yep.
yes.
From where we are. And I know we might talk more about writing, but tell me about the most this from where we are. Was this, I'm so curious always when I talk to authors,
Yes.
was this a COVID project? Or was this like, where did lockdown fall in the writing of this manuscript?
This one was mostly not a COVID project. So the my previous two of the books that I published previously are novels. Letters Are I'll Never Send and Until We Fall, and Until We Fall was written pretty much during the pandemic, and Letters was written in the month, written kind of like January, February before the pandemic, and it was queried and edited during the pandemic. But this one I actually started before those, and had kind of a very different idea of what it would be. And then maybe like 2 years later, a friend kind of offhand gave me a suggestion about, I had shown her kind of a little bit of the beginning, and she made a suggestion that kind of got me back working on it. So
Oh.
this is a many years in the making project, but the basic premise is that it's interconnected stories of this one family. It starts with a woman who is escaping Holocaust Germany as a Jewish refugee, and then kind of goes into detail about the different generations. So it spans from the early 1900s to the present day in different characters' points of view. So, but yes,
Amazing.
it was a long time coming.
Amazing. Did you to write an intergenerational story like that, is any of it reflect your family's history, or did you
For
interview
sure.
people, or so I'll just say
Yeah.
I
Yep.
converted to Judaism,
Okay.
so the Holocaust is not a part of my personal
Sure.
story. Well, it's a part of my like my
Yes.
community, right?
Yes.
So that's why I asked it in such a weird way.
Yeah, no, that I think that's a very good and a respectful way to ask. Yeah, I think a lot of it is very much based on my family story and based on the intergenerational trauma that comes with having family that has experienced a genocide. And so especially as the kind of more present day voices, I think, are a lot more reflective of my experience, friends' experiences that I see kind of in the current Jewish community, and then the older voice is much more reflective of kind of the stories of my great grandparents and the people who did flee that regime in Austria. But this is this family is German. But I think it's no one is kind of a direct, like you can't really point to any character and be like, oh yeah, this is your mom and this is, your grandfather. But it's those emotions, I think, and some parts of the stories I definitely pulled out of my own family and reworked for this.
Yeah. How did you track in a story that jumps generations and is woven together, how did you track your timelines?
So many notes.
Yeah.
I mentioned before I have OCD, so I'm a big plotter. Which goes with the neurodivergence. So I would have, these long timelines of, this is from when Gabby, the first kind of point of view character, is born in the 1900s all the way to the present day. I think the last bit takes place in, I want to say it's 2023. So very long timelines. I had these kind of very elaborate family trees of how everyone is related, and even characters that we don't necessarily meet in the story, I kind of had to have some idea of who they were and what their impact on other characters were, because we get to see those characters that they have that impact on. So lots of notes, just notebooks full of, and I still have things that are yet to come. Like I have all the blurb authors I'm going to be reaching out to, and so yes, lots of notes.
That's exciting. And you've got your publishing date. So it comes out in a year, a little less than a year. That's awesome. Then you also already have your 2025, All I Know So Far.
Yes, I'm happy to talk about that as well if
See,
you're
this is
up
why I'm
to
prolific, I think is fair to
listening.
say.
I'm very, very neurodivergent, and how I cope with my brain is writing. So that's definitely related. But so All I Know So Far comes out in 2025. It's with Inked and Gray Press. And this one had a little bit of a journey. It was with another press initially, that ended up shutting down for a couple reasons. I had actually pulled out of working with them right before they shut down for reasons, but I had spoken then. Once the press shut down, there were so many people that reached out on Twitter, especially, to say, if anyone is affected by this press shutting down, feel free to reach out, and I'll help in any way I can. I'll review your query, or I'll take a look at your manuscript XYZ. And so Lauren from Inked and Gray was one of those people who said that they would be willing to take a look at stuff, and eventually she ended up joining. She wasn't with Inked and Gray at the time, but she ended up joining them, and when she became their acquisitions editor, reached back out to me and said, hey, I really loved your manuscript, and we would love to publish it there. So I got very lucky with that. Had
So
some
exciting.
very yeah had some very generous people help me with the closure and all the craziness that came from that. But so this one is my first YA. So it follows a teenager, Avery Marsh, who, as her parents are getting divorced in California, they are sent off to live with their estranged half brother in what she calls middle of nowhere Virginia, and discovers upon landing in Virginia that actually the girlfriend that her older brother Lucas has been living with is actually a boyfriend, and that the brother had been very, very closeted. And this causes kind of a strain between the two of them, because Avery is bisexual and non-binary, and Lucas hadn't said anything when she came out and really struggled with her parents. So it follows Avery. It's also kind of a very little plot, just vibes adventure, very character driven. So follows Avery as she makes connections to these queer kids at her new school, and kind of discovers this queer community in the South, where even if she never really thought about it in these terms before, I think she kind of realizes the notions that she had of what it means to move to Virginia, and kind of dispels a lot of those. And it's very much based on the kind of community that I have here in Carrboro and have had in Chapel Hill. And wanted to kind of, it's kind of a love letter to queer communities in the South. So that's kind of the basic premise of that one. So yes, that comes out early 2025.
It couldn't be more timely if you tried.
Yeah, I'm excited about this one.
Yeah, what a deeply necessary book.
Yeah.
Hopefully, I mean, activists keep, you know, like today abortion was kept in Nebraska, access to abortion care. The activists and what people think are like red flyover states are doing incredible work. Yeah. And so I hope that when your book comes out next year, this this push of book bans has been pushed back.
Yeah. That's always a little bit scary. Sam Kern, who did recently, is kind of the mind behind the trans rights readathon that happened very recently. They put something on Twitter recently about, you know, yeah, let's just publish the most bannable, the most, you know, just kind of this call for authors to put out the, you know, the queerest, the most neurodivergent, the most, you know, kind of intersectional books that they possibly could. And I'm like, I'm already doing that. I don't need my books, if they were, you know, if red politicians got a hold of them, they would absolutely get banned. So, but yeah, I'm excited about that. And I think, you know, it's something that I've seen very recently, especially in light of everything that's happening. Florida, I think, is a really good example of, you know, people in different spaces keep saying, you know, oh, well, let's just get rid of Florida. We don't need Florida anyway. But there are activists in Florida and there are people in Florida doing so much amazing work. There are trans kids in Florida who can't be just dismissed like that.
Right.
And so I think it's important to have these different, you know, I've written queer folks in New York because that's another place that I'm familiar with.
Yeah.
But I think it's this kind of representation is different and is still very real.
Yeah. I think it's so important. I've got a half of my nibblings are from Idaho.
Sure.
And when my nephew Theo graduated college in Idaho, I went out there, and everyone in their friend group had a pronoun.
Yeah.
I sound like a boomer. I'm not. I'm proudly Gen X.
Yeah.
But like we were in Idaho, but still in like a queer space where every person there was wearing a pronoun sticker on their name tag.
That's truly, when people come to visit me in North Carolina, they're shocked by all the pride flags, but I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Continue.
No, it's just that like, if people don't see it or hear about it, they can't imagine it exists.
Yes.
And absolutely. That these vibrant communities exist and thrive and can't be ignored, can't be sacrificed.
Yes.
Because like fascism is a hungry beast, and we know it doesn't stop with trans people.
Yeah.
I think very clearly know that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's also very similar to kind of the narrative that was happening around COVID with disabilities and, you know, chronically ill folks with older folks that, you know, oh, we can just kind of don't worry about it. Like I'm not going to get COVID that badly. And, you know, it only affects people who are chronically ill. And I'm like, okay, but you know, us chronically ill people can hear you. Like that's so, yeah, I think that I would love for people to just care more about each other and be nicer to each other.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about Knee Brace Press?
Yes, absolutely.
So this is a magazine in that you created?
Yes. So founded this past November. So we, the primary thing we do is publish creatives writing about chronic conditions, disability, mental health, and neurodivergence. And so we've had poems, we've had essays, short stories, one audio story that was really awesome. We're looking for art, photos. And then we also publish author interviews. So anyone who writes a book about those topics is welcome to, you know, submit their information and, you know, talk to our interviewer, Allison Stahlberg, who's also a writer and really brilliant. And then the third thing that is happening this summer for the first time, it's going to be our first one, is a series of summer sessions where we have three folks doing creative work on each panel, on three panels about these topics. So the first panel we have in June is going to be about queer characters with chronic conditions. The second panel is about mental health and horror. And then the final panel is about memoir and essays about chronic conditions. So
wonderful.
Yes. I'm excited for that to take off.
Was that, did you feel like there wasn't a place publishing this type of content?
I think there are smaller places publishing, you know, smaller lit mags doing. I've worked with a lot of them. And I think that what I wanted to do was make a space that was also a resource for folks. So, you know, we have resources on our site, you know, agents who are looking for work about disability, and other lit mags that publish this also, right? Because even if our magazine isn't necessarily a fit for your work, I still, you know, I still want you to be successful. I still want you to get published. So we have those resources. And then also the kind of community aspect of doing these panels. And I was brought into the lit mag space via my friend Julian Esteban Torres Lopez runs the Nashona. And this is kind of the mindset that he had creating his baby, the Nashona. And so I think that's kind of the mindset that I have adopted, that he's generously let me adopt and has been super supportive in this creating this space. So
that's great. And you did a podcast for his publication, right?
Yeah. Yes. One of the first book that I published was with him. So we did a couple. And so because the National also has books published. So
okay.
We did a couple of podcasts about that, and then we did a series of podcasts that that he kind of let me run. About we did one about race, and then we have one in the works that's kind of been a long time coming because of everything that's happened with COVID. We filmed it, or we recorded the interviews a while ago, but it hasn't come out yet. But it's about different mental health and disabilities that people are dealing with largely in the pandemic. So
yeah. Outstanding. So, Nicole, we've already been talking about writing, but I am going to officially say, you know, your books and your literary magazine are what brought us together, but we're also here to talk about your favorite thing. And what is that?
My favorite thing ever in the world, or my favorite thing about writing specifically?
Well, sometimes I tell people something you love.
Yes.
Because in case you're worried that your number two favorite thing would be upset that it wasn't mentioned as your number one favorite thing.
Okay. Well, because I think my number one favorite thing in the world is my cat. But like, I think if we're talking about writing, I think that my favorite thing about writing specifically is I'm going to kind of backtrack a little bit. So I want to give some examples, but like when I was writing Letters I'll Never Send, which is a contemporary story about a woman who comes out of the psych hospital after a suicide attempt, and she kind of has to readjust to her life and figure out kind of what all of this means for her. And so many people reached out to me after, you know, just private messaged me or, you know, spoke to me in person just about what that representation meant to them. And I think that that's become one of my favorite things, is just having those conversations with people, because it's really cool to know that I am the person making people feel less alone. But also it's been really cathartic for me too, to kind of have these conversations and to to say, you know, this is pulled from my experience, and this is the kind of representation that I want to see in the world, and to have people validate that has been really cool. And then also just the writing, right? Like, again, it's just how I vibe. So,
yeah.
So just the writing part also is, you know, a favorite thing.
When did you start writing? Like, when did it go from, okay, I have learned how to write, to like, yes, I am keeping myself busy writing stories? Or
yeah,
was there a teacher that said, pointed you and was like, go, I think, go do this? When do you remember, like,
yeah,
that, like, sort of dear Mr. Henshaw moment of like, I'm a writer?
Sure. I've been writing badly for a long time.
Well, it's the only way you get to writing well.
It's the only way. So I started a series of books about a duck named Bill when I was in like elementary school, and I like illustrated it myself and stapled the pages backwards, and they were very bad. And my mom moved a couple years ago, and she's like devastated that she couldn't find them. And I was like, it's really okay. We don't need those in our life. But yeah, I think more around, I took a couple different creative writing, like there was a creative writing club in middle school that I did. And then, in high school, I had a creative writing teacher, Tiffany Molesky, who, you know, was kind of the first person that told me, like, no, that you're good at this. Like, you could definitely do this. And then, in college, I was on the writing track. I worked a lot with my advisor, Milan Dressler, who's also an author. Yeah, a lot of people have been very supportive. And then, my thesis in undergrad, I worked with Milan, and, that was that was a series of short stories. It was four short stories, and that ended up being included in my collection of short stories later. But those were the first short stories I ever published in like a non-college or high school literary magazine. So that was kind of the process. And then I guess I'll stop there. But
So essentially
always forever. Yes. Yeah.
Where did you go to undergrad?
Guilford College in Greensboro. So that was my introduction to North Carolina.
Okay.
So, yeah.
It's cool that your senior project, that your thesis was four short stories together that then you were able to put into a collection.
Yeah. Guilford was very writing focused. But it was also like the first couple of years I went to, you know, a public high school that just didn't really have the resources to cater to kids like me, neurodivergent kids who learn differently. And they were very STEM focused as well. So, you know, if you weren't in these advanced math and science classes, you were considered like, quote unquote, one of the dumb kids.
Yeah.
So I lived the first 18 years of my life just thinking it was stupid. And then went to college and, you know, found this community and these professors that supported me and, you know, was able to take classes and the things that I really enjoyed. And so I think that Guilford is a big part of the reason why I ended up publishing writing.
Yeah. Did you know, and if any of this is too personal, just be like, I'm edit.
I'm here now. Shoot, fire away.
Did you know in high school that you were neurodivergent? Or...
Yeah. So I was diagnosed with OCD when I was 7.
Okay.
But no one really knew how to deal with it then. I think even in the last couple of years, we've come a really long way. So I knew that I was neurodivergent, but I don't think it was until I was older that I looked back and was like, wow, the school was just not equipped to deal with that and didn't really have an understanding of what that was.
Yeah. I only got an ADHD diagnosis at 45.
Yeah.
So I do turn around and I'm like, oh, okay, all the crying.
Yeah. Oh, that makes sense. Yeah.
Now
yeah.
I understand all the this, yeah. all the like, it is, mm-hmm. it has brought some things into focus. You know, and I think about how school could have gone differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I was sort of that, it's like a, I can't find the word. It almost seems like a meme. The women in their 40s who were like in a gifted and talented program and like didn't get diagnosed until their 40s. Like I took that path exactly there, sort of.
Absolutely. There's a romance writer who like recently in the last couple of years was writing a book where one of her main characters had autism, and in doing the research she self-diagnosed.
Oh wow. So
I think stories like that also, as we understand more what it means to be neurodivergent, and as we start breaking those stigmas, I think stories like those are also just more common because those, you know, those resources and that access didn't necessarily exist just, you know, a couple decades ago.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It was only, boys who are hyperactive.
Yeah. Yes.
And so if you weren't that, you were fine.
Yeah.
Or not fine, but like there was no support or an explanation.
There was also a lot of you know, if you get this diagnosis, then you know, then you'll have this stigma attached to you. So there was kind of a barrier to getting a diagnosis that was culturally imposed as well.
I went out, like, once I read enough about it, once I hyperfixated on ADHD and I was like, this is for sure what I'm dealing with. I went out like aggressively seeking the test and
absolutely.
A psychiatrist to help manage it. And it was quite a journey.
Yeah. I think if nothing else, a diagnosis can be validating, right? Like you have those resources, you know, available to you, but also like I have fibromyalgia, which is physical chronic condition that you can't treat. There's no cure for it. The only things I can really do for it are, you know, manage the pain symptoms as they come. But just knowing that that is what I have, I'm like, oh, okay, I'm not losing my mind. Like, this is a very real thing that's happening to me. So.
Yeah. And you can start looking for the online and in-person communities and hear,
it's
like,
so important.
What are people... how are other people handling it? What are some tips and tricks and of how to manage the pain, how to find triggers for it?
Yeah.
All that
part
stuff.
Part of the reason I self-diagnosed first and then went to a specialist and said, I think this is what I have, which they hate, but there's no other way to get a diagnosis.
Yeah.
Part of the reason that I was able to do that is because I made a friend who had fibromyalgia, and in like listening to her talk about her experiences, I was like, that same, this is me, this is exactly what I'm going through. So that community is so important.
So keeping it on writing, sort of,
we're all over the place. It's all related, right?
It's all like related.
I write about chronic conditions, I write about mental health, it's all related.
So you mentioned that your book, Letters I'll Never Send, like you got a lot of feedback from that. Was there a time in college when you felt like you were starting to get feedback from people, not just artist to artist feedback, but like reader feedback from that? Or was it that you needed to be published in a bigger platform to start reaching people?
Well, I wasn't publishing like long stories in undergrad. I was writing, you know, even the short stories that I was writing for my thesis, you know, they were shorter and they were, you know, I was only really working with my advisor. So I think it was really later that started to happen. And it happens even when I'm not thinking about it, when I'm not, you know, like thinking to expect it. Like I have posted a lot on TikTok about all I know so far and how the main character is bisexual and non-binary, uses she, they pronouns. And so many people have in the comments just been like, oh, I use she, they pronouns, and that's really exciting to me. Or, you know, the main character's brother, his boyfriend has arthritis and fibro, both of which I have. And, you know, that kind of representation, you know, people I know with chronic conditions are excited about that. So I think it's just when you write about these real experiences and you write about these intersectionalities, you know, you're gonna touch on things that people seeing themselves that they haven't been able to see in media before. And that's been a really cool experience for me.
Yeah. Are you active in book talk?
Yes. Yes, I am. You can find me at Nicole Writes Books. But yeah, that's been a cool community too. And I've gotten a lot of book recs from them. So my, you know, bank account hates them, but I love them. So
yeah, it's, I have really, come to love TikTok.
Yeah.
And it's, like the algorithm is fascinating to me.
Yes. How it, as heck. Yes.
Yeah. And how creepy fast it locks in on who you are and what you want to see.
Yes. My entire For You page is like books, cats, and, you know, other gays. So that's, yes.
Yeah. Mine is like, you know, Gen X ADHD.
Yes.
So it's like domestic blisters and Leslie's ID, Corbett, like it's, mm-hmm. it's that. And then it's, I don't know, currently, I don't know if you're on the, if you're, if you are ever on the side of TikTok, that's just like random movie of the week in small clips. But this week it's the movie about Temple Grandin.
Sure.
Like, like every five or six, it's like, oh, here's another 3-minute clip out of order, but I'll piece it together in my brain.
Piece it together. You'll be fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, I follow a lot of book talk accounts. And then I've been able to connect with some really cool authors also. Camry Kohler just released Peachy, which is her debut novel. And I reached out to her when I had kind of started putting these panels together and asked, you know, if she wanted to be on this horror panel for Knee Brace about horror and mental health. And so we, you know, we've connected through that. And, you know, it's been a really cool way to kind of expand my writer community as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I have found that it is, it's nice to break out of, it's useful for breaking out of like your digital cul-de-sac.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I have found it because I mean, I've been on Tumblr forever.
Mm-hmm.
I've had my Tumblr years. I've had my Twitter years. You know, started blogging in 2003. But it sort of feels like the good days of Google Reader of like, even though it's an algorithm that drives the content you see, you also have like the full second, you know, like your inbox of what your friends are sharing with you. And the recommendations that I really enjoy.
Yes, absolutely. I just, like, based on all those recommendations, I ended up getting, like, 8 books in the Barnes & Noble pre-order sale, which was, like, not a thing that I meant to do. And then I was like, oh, these are all 25 off. And, you know, everyone is saying these books are so good. And I need them. And some of them aren't going to come for a year. But I want to spend money on them anyway. So now it's cheaper.
That's amazing. I love that.
Yes.
A lot of
them were book talk recommendations.
Yeah. I just today got pre-ordered Dan O'Brien's new book of poetry. Mm-hmm. He's got one book of poetry called Our Cancers, and then this one is a book about survivorship.
Sure.
Because he and his wife both survived cancer. So that was my pre-order today. And I was like, this will ship in August. I'm like, great. Yes.
Excellent. Yeah, some stuff that like I got like the sequel to Iron Widow. I was like, this doesn't come out until April 2024, but like I'm here for it.
Yeah, that's I didn't the pre-order sale Barnes and Noble's that missed me. What a bummer. Is it still going on?
It is going on until we are recording this on April 28th, and it is happening until midnight, I believe. So yeah.
Oh, okay.
So listeners will not be able to take advantage, but you can.
Okay, yes. Good.
Yes.
So let's see. So you mentioned when you're tracking your timelines and your books, lots of notes. Do you dictate your books? Do you type them? Are you a longhand on legal pads and then type it later?
Yeah, I am mostly typing. The notes that I am taking are often in my notebook, just kind of, so like I'll use my computer to type out like the actual thing, but then I have like, you know, kind of in my off time when I'm just, you know, kind of have some free time, I'll like start sketching out the family trees and the timelines and whatever else. Sometimes I do write scene, like if I'm really excited about a scene and, you know, I kind of have to like start working on it right now, I'll like start writing it in my notebook. So my notebooks are just a mess of, I have like all these tabs to indicate like, okay, this is, you know, something that's about this book, and this is something that's, you know, a scene, and this is something. So yeah, that's kind of a mess, but the bulk of the story usually gets written in Word.
I'm always curious how people, get the work done of writing. Is it mapping things out on the wall? Is it it's I think it's fascinating.
It's definitely, I mean, it's different for everyone. And I have friends that are straight up like pantsers. Like they just go into it completely not knowing even what the end is going to be. And I'm like, that scares me. You people terrify me.
So do you outline it before you go in, or you've thought your way all the way through it,
I
even if you
usually
don't?
outline it. And you know, things can change, and especially a lot of the kind of middle, I'll be like, okay, I know where this starts, and I know where I want it to end, and then I'll kind of draft scenes in the middle and then realize that they change. I've been working on something recently that I realized is actually, you know, the ending chapter actually needs to be like three chapters, and I need to like expand it. And so things can definitely change, but I always start with that kind of outline.
Awesome. So tell me about your cat.
Oh, she just came in. She's right here. She's playing with her mouse.
Ah.
Her name is Artemis. She was a pandemic foster fail.
Okay.
So when I was still living in Brooklyn, we were fostering cats, and you know, we had found good homes for a couple of them, and you know, I was planning on finding her a good home. And when they gave her to us, they said, you know, she's just had kittens. We're gonna adopt the kittens out. This is the mom. She might be feral. So we're gonna give her a chance at a foster home, but she hasn't reacted very well to people. So if she would rather live outside, we're gonna put her back outside. So we were kind of her last chance, and then if she, you know, if she did well with us, then we would adopt her out. But she oh she just got big zoomies. But she you know, I was living with a roommate at the time, and she could not give a crap about the roommate, but she saw me and was like, oh, this is my mom now. So like I was like the only one she'd come out for, like the only one allowed to give her, you know, head scratches. And you know, after a bit, my roommate at the time was like, no, this is your cat. This is She's imprinted on you, and this is she didn't want kittens. She wanted to be the kitten. She's very clingy. Yeah, I know I'm talking about you. She's right here. But yeah, so I was already planning on moving to North Carolina at the time. So my friend that I was planning on moving in with, I texted her and I said, you know, how would you feel if I brought a cat? And she was like, I don't, what are you doing? What is this? But she said yes because she's very nice to me. And yeah, so now she's been with me for about 2 years now. She's five and she's perfect.
And she's definitely an indoor cat. She was like, I
Definitely.
want to be indoors and I want to be with
She
Nicole.
hates the outside. I have right now in the apartment I'm living in, I have a screen and porch. She won't even come out there with me. Like I'll leave
No.
the door open for her to come out, and she's just like, no, I'm an indoor cat. This is, you've got me confused with someone else.
She did her time outside.
Yes. She's so picky. She's like, she'll only eat Fancy Feast. I'm like, you were eating trash out of a Brooklyn dumpster. Like, come on. Come on.
Yeah, Cowboy's a Fancy Feast boy. He was I in the, universal cat distribution. He came to me from a coworker who he and his family were just like not cat people. And so he was two, and they'd had him since he was a kitten, but he was not a very social guy because he was being raised by people who weren't cat people.
Oh, that's so sad.
Yeah, the only benefit of that is that he's not interested in human food. And until last summer, I had a cat who was almost 21, Spidey, who I rescued from the patio of a restaurant where I was the waitress. So until the day he died, only wanted human food. And he would steal the hamburger off your plate and take it to the other room. Like, he was a rascal.
That's when I was living with my friend in Chapel Hill, she and her boyfriend at the time got hibachi, and neither of them like mushrooms, so they left the mushrooms on the counter in the box. But she managed to, you know, tear open the bag, undo the box, get the mushroom, run into my room. She makes direct eye contact with me. I'm like, what the heck do you have in your mouth?
Right.
She dives under the bag. Yeah. It was fried. I was like, that could be anything.
Yeah.
So I had to, and she went like full on feral with the growling, and I'm like, you don't scare me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not gonna bite me. So
right.
I managed to get it away from her, but she's so gentle, and I'm like, I don't understand how people ever thought you would live on the street. And then I'll have friends over, and she just glares at them from the other side of the apartment. I'm like, oh, that's why.
Yeah.
That I understand now.
Oh, I love being with cats.
Yeah.
Cowboy has come out of his shell as an only cat.
Yes.
I have learned that Spidey wouldn't let him cuddle with me. It's not that he didn't want to cuddle.
Yes.
It's that Spidey was in charge.
Yeah. I think Artemis would like a sibling one day, but I need the spoons for it. So
yeah.
And the savings. So
yeah.
Nice. But yeah. I'm definitely a cat and dog person. I grew up with dogs, but I my roommate in Brooklyn had a cat, and then we started fostering cats, and I was like, oh, this is so much easier.
It's so much easier.
It's so much easier.
You don't ever have to clean up poop outside in the winter.
No. I'm like, I want all my friends to get dogs so I can play with them and then go home to my cat.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love
the building I live in, almost everyone has cats, I think, except for one person, two people maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah,
all my friends here have cats. I have these two friends that foster cats, and right now they have like a mom and four kittens in their house. Like, it's just cat central.
Yeah, I am tempted to foster like kittens. I would love to do that, but I also know I would fail. And you know, Cowboy's 14. Mm-hmm. He's a senior cat. He deserves to have like a quiet retirement.
Sure. Yes.
So absolutely. I'm resisting the urge to go and get a pair of like bonded kittens, but I want them so bad.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. They thought for a time that, you know, they might try to adopt out Artemis with one of her kittens. And then she made it very clear that was not the vibe. She really likes other cats, but she's not a mom. She's like, this is not, no, I need to be mom. I need to be the baby.
Yeah. Yeah. Heal her inner kitten.
Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's my cat.
Awesome. Nicole, is there anything about writing or cat rooming
or cats,
or cats that I haven't asked you yet that you would want to share?
That's a good question. I think I would just love to emphasize that, like, while writing can be very much a kind of like solo act, and it's very like, I do a lot of my, you know, writing on my own, and you know, that works for me as an introvert, and I love that. But you really, it is very much a community as well, and it is very much. I would not be where I am today if I did not have my writing community and my people. So, just to emphasize that about cats, I think we've covered it all. So
yeah,
they're just delightful.
Where can people follow you online?
Yes. So I am on Twitter and Instagram at Nicole Zelniker. So that's NicoleZelniker. And then I am on TikTok at Nicole Writes Books.
Outstanding. And people can, now are your books available for pre-order yet?
Not yet, but
okay.
Keep an eye out. All of my published books are available wherever you can find books. And then if you want to order it from bookshop, then your local indie store will order them. And yes, I am hoping for pre-orders from Where We Are in the coming months. So we'll talk about that on my socials. So be sure to follow.
Yeah. I did in the last couple months, I finally set up, because I talked to so many authors.
Yeah.
Bookshop has, like, you can make an affiliate storefront. just as an internet person. And so I'm not concerned about the like making money from the store, but I was like, oh, I can make a bookshop with literally every book that all of the authors, like I can make a shelf of all of my guests' books. So people can look for, I will link your books in the,
I appreciate that.
Yeah. In the bookshop.
Yeah. I think for some reason Until We Fall isn't on bookshop, but all of the other ones are, and you can still get Until We Fall from anywhere else. So.
Great. Well, Nicole, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This has been really
wonderful.
Yes, I've enjoyed this conversation. So,
thank you for listening to Finding Favorites with Leah Jones. Please make sure to subscribe and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Now, go out and enjoy your favorite things.